any familiar to me. I'd grown up attending my great-aunt Robbie's weekly operetta workshop in an African Methodist Episcopal church not unlike this one. The women in the room were no different from the ladies who sang in Robbie's choir or who'd turn up with casseroles after Southside died. They were well-intentioned, community-minded women, often single mothers or grandmothers, the type who inevitably stepped in to help when no one else would volunteer. Barack hung his suit jacket on the back of his chair and took off his wristwatch, laying it on the table in front of him to keep an eye on the time. After introducing himself, he facilitated a conversation that would last about an hour, asking people to share their stories and describe their concerns about life in the neighborhood. Barack, in turn, shared his own story, tying it to the principles of community organizing. He was there to convince them that our stories connected us to one another, and through those connections, it was possible to harness discontent and convert it to something useful. Even they, he said, a tiny group inside a small church in what felt like a forgotten neighborhood, could build real political power. It took effort, he cautioned. It required mapping strategy and listening to your neighbors and building trust in communities where trust was often lacking. It meant asking people you'd never met to give you a bit of their time or a tiny piece of their paycheck. It involved being told no in a dozen or 100 different ways before hearing the yes that would make all the difference. This, it seemed, was a large part of what an organizer did. But he assured them they could have influence. They could make change. He'd seen the process work, if not always smoothly, in the Altgeld Gardens public housing project, where a group just like this one had managed to register new voters and rally residents to meet with city officials about asbestos contamination and persuade the mayor's office to fund a neighborhood job training center. The heavyset woman sitting next to me bounced a toddler on her knee and did nothing to hide her skepticism. She inspected Barack with her chin lifted and her bottom lip stuck out as if to say, "Who are you to be telling us what to do?" But skepticism didn't bother him, the same way long odds didn't bother him. Barack was a unicorn, after all, shaped by his unusual name, his odd heritage, his hard-to-pin-down ethnicity, his missing dad, his unique mind. He was used to having to prove himself pretty much anywhere he went. The idea he was presenting wasn't an easy sell, nor should it have been. Roseland had taken one hit after another, from the exodus of white families and the bottoming out of the steel industry to the deterioration of its schools and the flourishing of the drug trade. As an organizer working in urban communities, Barack had told me, he'd contended most often with a deep weariness in people, especially Black people, a cynicism bred from a thousand small disappointments over time. I understood it. I'd seen it in my own neighborhood, in my own family. A bitterness, a lapse in faith. It lived in both of my grandfathers, spawned by every goal they'd abandoned and every compromise they'd had to make. It was inside the harried second-grade teacher who'd basically given up trying to teach us at Bryn Mawr. It was inside the neighbor who'd stopped mowing her lawn or keeping track of where her kids went after school. It lived in every piece of trash tossed carelessly in the grass at our local park and every ounce of malt liquor drained before dark. It lived in every last thing we deemed unfixable, including ourselves. Barack didn't talk down to the people of Roseland, and he wasn't trying to win them over either by hiding his privilege and acting more Black. Amid the parishioners' fears and frustrations, their disenfranchisement and sinking helplessness, He was somewhat brashly pointing an arrow in the opposite direction. I'd never been someone who dwelled on the more demoralizing parts of being African American. I'd been raised to think positively. I'd absorbed my family's love and my parents' commitment to seeing us succeed. I stood with Santita Jackson at Operation Push rallies, listening to her father call for Black people to remember their pride. My purpose had always been to see past my neighborhood, to look ahead and overcome. And I had. I'd scored myself 2 Ivy League degrees. I had a seat at the table at Sidley and Austin. I'd made my parents and grandparents proud. But listening to Barack, I began to understand that his version of hope reached far beyond mine. It was one thing to get yourself out of a stuck place, I realized. It was another thing entirely to try and get the place itself unstuck. I was gripped all over again by a sense of how special he was. Slowly all around me, too, the church ladies began nodding their approval, punctuating his sentences with calls of, "Mm-hmm, and that's right." His voice climbed in intensity as he got to the end of his pitch. He wasn't a preacher, but he was definitely preaching something, a vision. He was making a bid for our investment. The choice as he saw it was this: you give up or you work for change. "What's better for us?" Barack called to the people gathered in the room. "Do we settle for the world as it is, or do we work for the world as it should be?" It was a phrase borrowed from a book he'd read when he first started out as an organizer, and it would stay with me for years. It was as close as I'd come to understanding what motivated Barack: the world as it should be. Next to me, the woman with the toddler on her lap all but exploded. "That's right," she bellowed, finally convinced. "Amen." Amen, I thought to myself, because I was convinced too. Before he returned to law school, sometime in the middle of August, Barack told me he loved me. The feeling had flowered between us so quickly and naturally that there was nothing especially memorable about the moment itself. I don't recall when or how exactly it happened. It was just an articulation, tender and meaningful, of the thing that had caught us both by surprise. Even though we'd known each other only a couple of months, even though it was kind of impractical, we were in love. But now we had to navigate the more than 900 miles that would separate us. Barack had 2 years of school left and said he hoped to settle in Chicago when he was done. There was no expectation that I would leave my life there in the interim. As a still newish associate at Sidley, I understood that the next phase of my career was critical, that my accomplishments would determine whether I made partner or not. Having been through law school myself, I also knew how busy Barack would be. He'd been chosen as an editor on the Harvard Law Review, a monthly student-run journal that was considered one of the top legal publications in the country. It was an honor to be picked for the editorial team, but it was also like tacking a full-time job onto the already heavy load of being a law student. What did this leave us with? It left us with the phone. Keep in mind that this was 1989 when phones didn't live in our pockets. Texting wasn't a thing. No emoji could sub for a kiss. The phone required both time and mutual availability. Personal calls happened usually at home at night when you were dog tired and in need of sleep. Barack told me ahead of leaving that he preferred letter writing. "I'm not much of a phone guy," was how he put it, as if that settled it. But it settled nothing. We'd just spent the whole summer talking. I wasn't going to relegate our love to the creeping pace of the Postal Service. This was another small difference between us. Barak could pour his heart out through a pen. He'd been raised on letters, sustenance arriving in the form of wispy airmail envelopes from his mom in Indonesia. I, meanwhile, was an in-your-face sort of person, brought up on Sunday dinners at Southside's, where you sometimes had to shout to be heard. In my family, we gabbed. My dad, who recently traded in his car for a specialized van to accommodate his disability, still made a point of showing up in his cousin's doorways as often as possible for in-person visits. Friends, neighbors, and cousins of cousins also regularly turned up on Euclid Avenue and planted themselves in the living room next to my father in his recliner to tell stories and ask for advice. Even David, my old high school boyfriend, sometimes dropped in to seek his counsel. My dad had no problem with the phone either. For years, I'd seen him call my grandmother in South Carolina almost daily, asking for her news. I informed Barak that if our relationship was going to work, he better get comfortable with the phone. If I'm not talking to you, I announced, I might have to find another guy who'll listen. I was joking, but only a little. And so it was that Barak became a phone guy. Over the course of that fall, we spoke as often as we could manage, both of us locked into our respective worlds and schedules, but still sharing the little details of our days, commiserating over the heap of corporate tax cases he had to read, or laughing about how I'd taken sweating out my office frustrations at after-work aerobics. As months passed, our feelings stayed steady and reliable. For me, it became one less thing in life to question. At Sidley and Austin, I was part of the Chicago office's recruiting team, tasked with interviewing Harvard Law students for summer associate jobs. It was essentially a wooing process. As a student, I'd experienced for myself the power and temptation of the corporate law industrial complex, having been given a binder as thick as a dictionary that listed law firms across the country and told that every one of them was interested in landing Harvard-educated lawyers. It would seem that with the imprimatur of a Harvard JD, you had a shot at working in any city in any field of law, whether it be a big mammoth litigation firm in Dallas or a boutique real estate firm in New York. If you were curious about any of them, you requested an on-campus interview, and if that went well, you were then treated to a flyout, which amounted to a plane ticket, a 5-star hotel room, and another round of interviews at the firm's office, followed by some extravagant wine and dine experience with recruiters like me. While at Harvard, I'd availed myself of flyouts to San Francisco and Los Angeles, in large part to check out entertainment law practices there, but also, if I was honest, because I'd never been to California. Now that I was at Sidley and on the other side of the recruiting experience, my goal was to bring in law students who were not just smart and hard-driving, but also something other than male and white. There was exactly one other African-American woman on the recruiting team, a senior associate named Mercedes Lang. Mercedes was about 10 years older than I was and became a dear friend and mentor. Like me, she had 2 Ivy League degrees and routinely sat at tables where nobody looked like her. The struggle, we agreed, was not to get used to it or accept it. In meetings on recruitment, I argued insistently, and I'm sure brazenly in some people's opinions, that the firm cast a wider net when it came to finding young talent. The long-held practice was to engage students from a select group of law schools, Harvard, Stanford, Yale, Northwestern, the University of Chicago, and the University of Illinois, primarily, the places where most of the firm's lawyers had earned their degrees. It was a circular process, one generation of lawyers hiring new lawyers whose life experience mirrored their own, leaving little room for diversity of any sort. In fairness to Sidley, this was a problem, whether recognized or not, at virtually every big firm in the country. A National Law Journal survey from the time found that in large firms, African Americans made up not quite 3% of all associates and less than 1% of all partners. Trying to help remedy the imbalance, I push for us to consider law students coming from other state schools and from historically Black colleges like Howard University. When the recruiting team gathered in a conference room in Chicago with a pile of student resumes to review, I objected any time a student was automatically dismissed for having a B on a transcript or for having gone to a less prestigious undergraduate program. If we were serious about bringing in minority lawyers, I asserted, we'd have to look more holistically at candidates. We'd need to think about how they'd use whatever opportunities life had afforded them, rather than measuring them simply by how far they'd made it up an elitist academic ladder. The point wasn't to lower the firm's high standards. It was to realize that by sticking with the most rigid and old-school way of evaluating a new lawyer's potential, we were overlooking all sorts of people who could contribute to the firm's success. We needed to interview more students, in other words, before writing them off. For this reason, I loved making recruitment trips to Cambridge because it gave me some influence in which Harvard students got chosen for an interview. It also, of course, gave me an excuse to see Barack. The first time I visited, he picked me up in his car, a snub-nosed, banana-yellow Datsun he'd bought used on his loan-strapped student budget. When he turned the key, the engine revved and the car spasmed violently before settling into a loud, sustained juddering that shook us in our seats. I looked at Barack in disbelief. "You drive this thing?" I said, raising my voice over the noise. He flashed me the impish, "I got this covered" grin that melted me every time. "Just give it a minute or two," he said, shifting the car into gear. "It goes away." After another few minutes, having steered us onto a busy road, he added, "Also, maybe don't look down." I'd already spotted what he wanted me to avoid, a rusted-out 4-inch hole in the floor of his car, through which I could see the pavement rushing beneath us. Life with Barack would never be dull. I knew it even then. It would be some version of banana yellow and slightly hair-raising. It occurred to me, too, that quite possibly the man would never make any money. He was living in a Spartan one-bedroom apartment in Somerville. But during my recruiting trips, Sidley put me up at the Lux Charles Hotel adjacent to campus, where we slept on smooth, high-quality sheets, and Barack, rarely one to cook for himself, could load up on a hot breakfast before his morning classes. In the evenings, he parked himself in my room and did his schoolwork, giddily dressed in one of the hotel's thick terry cloth robes. At Christmas time that year, we flew to Honolulu. I'd never been to Hawaii before, but was pretty certain I'd like it. I was coming from Chicago, after all, where winter stretched through April, where it was normal to keep a snow shovel stashed in the trunk of your car. I owned an unsettling amount of wool. For me, getting away from winter had always felt like a joyride. During college, I'd made a trip to the Bahamas with my Bahamian classmate David, and another to Jamaica with Suzanne. In both instances, I'd reveled in the soft air on my skin and the simple buoyancy I felt any time I got close to the ocean. Maybe it was no accident that I was drawn to people who'd been raised on islands. In Kingston, Suzanne had taken me to powdery white beaches where we dodged waves in water that looked like jade. She'd piloted us expertly through a chaotic market, jabbering with street vendors. "Try this," she'd shouted at me, going full throttle with the accent, exuberantly handing me pieces of grilled fish to taste, handing me fried yams, stalks of sugarcane, and cut-up pieces of mango. She demanded I try everything, intent on getting me to see how much there was to love. It was no different with Barack. By now, he'd spent more than a decade on the mainland, but Hawaii mattered to him deeply. He wanted me to take it all in, from the splaying palm trees that line the streets of Honolulu and the crescent arc of Waikiki Beach to the green drape of hills surrounding the city. For about a week, we stayed in a borrowed apartment belonging to family friends and made trips every day to the ocean to swim and laze about in the sun. I met Barack's half-sister Maya, who at 19 was kind and smart and getting a degree at Barnard. She had round cheeks and wide brown eyes and dark hair that curled in a rich tangle around her shoulders. I met his grandparents, Madeline and Stanley Dunham, or Toot and Gramps, as he called them. They lived in the same high-rise where they'd raised Barack, in a small apartment decorated with Indonesian textiles that Anne had sent home over the years. And I met Anne herself, a plump, lively woman with dark, frizzy hair and the same angular chin as Barack. She wore chunky silver jewelry, a bright batik dress, and the kind of sturdy sandals I would guess an anthropologist might wear. She was friendly toward me and curious about my background and my career. It was clear she adored her son, almost revered him, and she seemed most eager to sit down and talk with him, describing her dissertation work and swapping book recommendations as if catching up with an old friend. Everyone in the family still called him Barry, which I found endearing. Though they'd left their home state of Kansas back in the 1940s, his grandparents seemed to me like the misplaced Midwesterners Barack had always described them as. Gramps was big and bear-like and told silly jokes. Toot, a stout, gray-haired woman who'd worked her way up to becoming the vice president of a local bank, made us tuna salad sandwiches for lunch. In the evenings, she served Ritz crackers piled with sardines for appetizers and put dinner on TV trays so that everyone could watch the news or play a heated game of Scrabble. They were a modest, middle-class family, in many ways not at all unlike my own. There was something comforting in this for both me and Barack. As different as we were, we fit together in an interesting way. It was as if the reason for the ease and attraction between us was now being explained. In Hawaii, Barack's intense and brainy side receded somewhat while the laid-back part of him flourished. He was at home, and home was where he didn't feel the need to prove anything to anyone. We were late for everything we did, but it didn't matter. Not even to me. Barack's high school buddy Bobby, who was a commercial fisherman, took us out on his boat one day for some snorkeling and an aimless cruise. It was then that I saw Barack as relaxed as I'd ever seen him, lounging under a blue sky with a cold beer and an old friend, no longer fixated on the day's news or law school reading or what should be done about income inequality. The sun-bleached mellowness of the island opened up space for the two of us, in part by giving us time we'd never before had. So many of my friends judged potential mates from the outside in, focusing first on their looks and financial prospects. If it turned out the person they'd chosen wasn't a good communicator or was uncomfortable with being vulnerable, they seemed to think time or marriage vows would fix the problem. But Barack had arrived in my life a wholly formed person. From our very first conversation, he'd shown me that he wasn't self-conscious about expressing fear or weakness, and that he valued being truthful. At work, I'd witnessed his humility and willingness to sacrifice his own needs and wants for a bigger purpose. And now in Hawaii, I could see his character reflected in other small ways. His long-lasting friendships with his high school buddies showed his consistency in relationships. In his devotion to his strong-willed mother, I saw a deep respect for women and their independence. Without needing to discuss it outright, I knew he could handle a partner who had her own passions and voice. These were things you couldn't teach in a relationship, things that not even love could really build or change. In opening up his world to me, Barack was showing me everything I'd ever need to know about the kind of life partner he'd be. One afternoon, we borrowed a car and drove to the north shore of Oahu, where we sat on a ribbon of soft beach and watched surfers rip across enormous waves. We stayed for hours just talking as one wave tipped into the next, as the sun dropped toward the horizon and the other beachgoers packed up to go home. We talked as the sky turned pink and then purple and finally went dark, as the bugs started to bite, as we began to get hungry. If I'd come to Hawaii to sample something of Barack's past, we were now sitting at the edge of a giant ocean, trying on a version of the future, discussing what kind of house we'd want to live in someday, what kind of parents we wanted to be. It felt speculative and a little daring to talk like this, but it was also reassuring because it seemed as if maybe we'd never stop, that maybe this conversation between us could go on for life. Back in Chicago, separated again from Barack, I still sometimes went to my old happy hour gatherings, though I rarely stayed out late. Barack's dedication to reading had brought out a new bookishness in me. I was now content to spend a Saturday night reading a good novel on the couch. When I got bored, I called up old friends. Even now that I had a serious boyfriend, my girlfriends were the ones who held me steady. Santita Jackson was now traveling the country as a backup singer for Roberta Flack, but we spoke when we could. A year or so earlier, I'd sat with my parents in their living room, bursting with pride as we watched Santita and her siblings introduce their father at the 1988 Democratic National Convention. Reverend Jackson had made a respectable run for the presidency, winning about a dozen primaries before ceding the nomination to Michael Dukakis. Along the way, he'd filled households like ours with a new and profound level of hope and excitement, even if in our hearts we understood that he was a long shot's long shot. I spoke regularly with Verna Williams, a close friend from law school, who until recently had been living in Cambridge. She'd met Barack a couple of times and liked him a lot, but teased me that I'd let my insanely high standards slip, having allowed a smoker into my life. Angela Kennedy and I still laughed hard together, even though she was working as a teacher in New Jersey while also parenting a young son and trying to hold herself steady as her marriage slowly imploded. We'd known each other as goofy, half-mature college girls, and now we were adults with adult lives and adult concerns. That idea alone sometimes struck us as hilarious. Suzanne, meanwhile, was the same free spirit she'd been when we roomed together at Princeton, flitting in and out of my life with varying predictability, continuing to measure the value of her days purely by whether they were pleasurable or not. We'd go long stretches without talking, but then pick up the thread of our friendship with ease. As always, I called her Scroozy, and she called me Mish. Our worlds continued to be as different as they'd been at school, when she was trekking off to eating club parties and kicking her dirty laundry under the bed, and I was color-coding my sociology 201 notes. Even then, Suzanne was like a sister whose life I could only track from afar, across the gulf of our inherent differences. She was maddening, charming, and always important to me. She'd ask my advice and then willfully ignore it. Would it be bad to date a philandering, semi-famous pop star? Why, yes, it would, but she'd do it anyway, because why not? Most galling to me was when she turned down an opportunity to go to an Ivy League business school after college, deciding that it would be too much work and therefore no fun. Instead, she got her MBA from a not-so-stressful program at a state school, which I viewed as kind of a lazy move. Suzanne's choices sometimes seem like an affront to my way of doing things, a vote in favor of easing up and striving less. I can say now that I judged her unfairly for them. At the time, though, I just thought I was right. Not long after I started dating Barack, I called Suzanne to gush about my feelings for him. She'd been thrilled to hear me so happy, happiness being her currency. She also had news of her own. She was ditching her job as a computer specialist at the Federal Reserve and going traveling, not for weeks, but for months. Suzanne and her mom were soon to head off on some round-the-world-styled adventure, because why not? I could never guess whether Suzanne knew unconsciously that something strange was happening in the cells of her body, that a silent hijacking was already underway. What I did know was that during the fall of 1989, while I wore patent leather pumps and sat through long, dull conference room meetings at Sidley, Suzanne and her mother were trying not to spill curry on their sundresses in Cambodia and dancing at dawn on the grand walkways of the Taj Mahal as I balanced my checkbook, picked up my dry cleaning, and watched the leaves wither and drop from the trees along Euclid Avenue. Suzanne was careening through hot, humid Bangkok in a tuk-tuk, hooting as I imagined it with joy. I don't, in fact, know what any of her travels looked like or where she actually went, because she wasn't one to send postcards or keep in touch. She was too busy living, stuffing herself full of what the world had to give. By the time she got home to Maryland and found a moment to reach out to me, the news was different, so clanging and dissonant from my image of her that I could hardly take it in. "I have cancer," Suzanne told me, her voice husky with emotion. "A lot of it." Her doctors had just diagnosed it, an aggressive form of lymphoma already ravaging her organs. She described a plan for treatment, pegging some hope to what the results could be, but I was too overwhelmed to note the details. Before hanging up, she told me that in a cruel twist of fate, her mother had fallen gravely ill as well. I'm not sure that I ever believed that life was fair, but I had always thought that you could work your way out of just about any problem. Suzanne's cancer was the first real challenge to that notion, a sabotage of my ideals. Because even if I didn't have the specifics nailed down yet, I did have ideas about the future. I had that agenda I'd been assiduously maintaining since freshman year of college, stemming from the neat line of boxes I was meant to check. For me and Suzanne, it was supposed to go like this. We'd be the maids of honor at each other's weddings. Our husbands would be really different, of course, but they'd like each other a lot anyway. We'd have babies at the same time, take family beach trips to Jamaica, remain mildly critical of each other's parenting techniques, and be favorite fun aunties to each other's kids as they grew. I'd get her kids books for their birthdays. She'd get mine pogo sticks. We'd laugh and share secrets and roll our eyes at what we perceived as the other person's ridiculous idiosyncrasies until one day we'd realize we were two old ladies who'd been best friends forever, flummoxed suddenly by where the time had gone. That, for me, was the world as it should be. What I find remarkable in hindsight is how, over the course of that winter and spring, I just did my job. I was a lawyer, and lawyers worked. We worked all the time. We were only as good as the hours we billed. There was no choice, I told myself. The work was important, I told myself. And so I kept showing up every morning in downtown Chicago at the corporate ant mound known as One First National Plaza. I put my head down and billed my hours. Back in Maryland, Suzanne was living with her disease. She was coping with medical appointments and surgeries, and at the same time trying to care for her mother, who was also fighting an aggressive cancer that was, the doctors insisted, completely unrelated to Suzanne's. It was bad luck, bad fortune, freakish to the point of being too scary to contemplate. The rest of Suzanne's family was not particularly close-knit, except for two of her favorite female cousins who helped her out as much as they could. Angela drove down from New Jersey to visit sometimes, but she was juggling both a toddler and a job. I enlisted Verna, my law school friend, to go by when she could, as a sort of proxy for me. Verna had met Suzanne a couple of times while we were at Harvard, and by sheer coincidence was now living in Silver Spring in a building just across the parking lot from Suzanne's. It was a lot to ask of Verna, who'd recently lost her father and was wrestling with her own grief. But she was a true friend, a compassionate person. She phoned my office one day in May to relay the details of a visit. "I combed her hair," she said. That Suzanne needed to have her hair combed should have told me everything, but I'd walled myself off from the truth. Some part of me still insisted this wasn't happening. I held on to the idea that Suzanne's health would turn around, even as the evidence against it stacked up. It was Angela finally who called me in June and got right to the point. "If you're gonna come, Mish," she said, "you'd better get to it." By then, Suzanne had been moved to a hospital. She was too weak to talk, slipping in and out of consciousness. There was nothing left to feed my denial. I hung up the phone and bought a plane ticket. I flew east, caught a taxi to the hospital, took the elevator to the right floor, walked the hallway to her room, and found her there, lying in bed, as Angela and her cousin watched over her. Everyone silent. Suzanne's mother, it turned out, had died just a few days earlier, and now Suzanne was in a coma. Angela made room for me to perch on the side of her bed. I stared hard at Suzanne, at her perfect heart-shaped face and reddish-brown skin, feeling comforted somehow by the youthful smoothness of her cheeks and the girlish curve in her lips. She seemed oddly undiminished by the illness. Her dark hair was still lustrous and long. Someone had put it in two ropey braids that reached almost to her waist. Her track runner legs lay hidden beneath the blankets. She looked young, like a sweet, beautiful 26-year-old who was maybe in the middle of a nap. I regretted not coming earlier. I regretted the many times over the course of our seesawing friendship that I'd insisted she was making a wrong move, when possibly she'd been doing it right. I was suddenly glad for all the time she'd ignored my advice. I was glad that she hadn't overworked herself to get some fancy business school degree, that she'd gone off for a lost weekend with a semi-famous pop star just for fun. I was happy that she'd made it to the Taj Mahal to watch the sunrise with her mom. Suzanne had lived in ways that I had not. That day, I held her limp hand and watched as her breathing grew ragged, as eventually there were long pauses between her inhales. At some point, the nurse gave us a knowing nod. It was happening. Suzanne was leaving. My mind went dark. I had no deep thoughts. I had no revelations about life or loss. If anything, I was mad. To say that it was unfair that Suzanne got sick and died at 26 seems too simple a thing, but it was a fact, as cold and ugly as they come. What I was thinking as I finally left her body in that hospital room was this. She's gone, and I'm still here. Outside in the hallway, there were people wandering in hospital gowns who were far older and sicker looking than Suzanne, and they were still here. I would take a packed flight back to Chicago, drive along a busy highway, ride an elevator up to my office. I'd see all these people looking happy in their cars, walking the sidewalk in their summer clothes, sitting idly in cafes, and working at their desks, all of them oblivious to what happened to Suzanne, apparently unaware that they too could die at any moment. It felt perverse how the world just carried on, how everyone was still here, except for my Suzanne. 10. That summer, I started keeping a journal. I bought myself a cloth-bound black book with purple flowers on the cover and kept it next to my bed. I took it with me when I went on business trips for Sidley and Austin. I was not a daily writer or even a weekly writer. I picked up a pen only when I had the time and energy to sort through my jumbled feelings. I'd write a few entries in a single week and then lay the journal down for a month or sometimes more. I was not by nature especially introspective. The whole exercise of recording one's thoughts was new to me, a habit I'd picked up in part, I suppose, from Barack, who viewed writing as therapeutic and clarifying and had kept journals on and off over the years. He'd come back to Chicago over his summer break from Harvard, this time skipping the sublet and moving directly into my apartment on Euclid Avenue. This meant not only that we were learning in a real way how to cohabitate as a couple, but also that Barack got to know my family in a more intimate way. He talked sports with my dad as he headed out for a shift at the water plant. He sometimes helped my mother carry her groceries from the garage. It was a good feeling. Craig had already assessed Barack's character in the most thorough and revealing way he could by including him in a high-octane weekend basketball game with a bunch of his buddies, most of them former college players. He'd done this actually at my request. Craig's opinion of Barack mattered to me, and my brother knew how to read people, especially in the context of a game. Barack had passed the test. He was smooth on the floor, my brother said, and knew when to make the right pass, but he also wasn't afraid to shoot when he was open. He's no ball hog, Craig said, but he's got guts. Barack had accepted a summer associate job with a downtown firm whose offices were close to Sidley's, but his time in Chicago was short. He'd been elected president of the Harvard Law Review for the coming academic year, which meant he'd be responsible for turning out 8 issues of about 300 pages each and would need to get back to Cambridge early in order to get started. The competition to lead the review was ferocious every year, involving rigorous vetting and a vote by 80 student editors. Being picked for the position was an enormous achievement for anyone. It turned out that Barack was also the first African-American in the publication's 103-year history to be selected, a milestone so huge that it had been written up in the New York Times, accompanied by a photo of Barack, smiling in a scarf and winter coat. My boyfriend, in other words, was a big deal. He could have landed any number of fat-salaried law firm jobs at that point. But instead, he was thinking about practicing civil rights law once he got his degree, even if it would then take twice as long to pay off his student loans. Practically everyone he knew was urging him to follow the lead of many previous review editors and apply for what would be a shoo-in clerkship with the Supreme Court. But Barack was uninterested. He wanted to live in Chicago. He had ideas for writing a book about race in America, and planned, as he said, to find work that aligned with his values, which most likely meant he wouldn't end up in corporate law. He steered himself with a certainty that I found astounding. All this inborn confidence was admirable, of course, but honestly, try living with it. For me, coexisting with Barack's strong sense of purpose, sleeping in the same bed with it, sitting at the breakfast table with it, was something to which I had to adjust. Not because he flaunted it exactly, but because it was so alive. In the presence of his certainty, his notion that he could make some sort of difference in the world, I couldn't help but feel a little lost by comparison. His sense of purpose seemed like an unwitting challenge to my own. Hence, the journal. On the very first page, in careful handwriting, I spelled out my reasons for starting it. 1. I feel very confused about where I want my life to go, what kind of person I want to be, how do I want to contribute to the world. 2. I'm getting very serious in my relationship with Barack, and I feel that I need to get a better handle on myself. This little flowered book has now survived a couple of decades and multiple moves. It sat on a shelf in my dressing room at the White House for 8 years until very recently, when I pulled it out from a box in my new home to try to reacquaint myself with who I'd been as a young lawyer. I read those lines today and see exactly what I was trying to tell myself. What a no-nonsense female mentor might have said to me directly. Really, it was simple. The first thing was that I hated being a lawyer. I wasn't suited to the work. I felt empty doing it, even if I was plenty good at it. This was a distressing thing to admit, given how hard I'd worked and how in debt I was. In my blinding drive to excel, in my need to do things perfectly, I'd missed the signs and taken the wrong road. The second was that I was deeply, delightfully in love with a guy whose forceful intellect and ambition could possibly end up swallowing mine. I saw it coming already, like a barreling wave with a mighty undertow. I wasn't going to get out of its path. I was too committed to Barack by then, too in love. But I did need to quickly anchor myself on 2 feet. This meant finding a new profession. And what shook me most was that I had no concrete ideas about what I wanted to do. Somehow, in all my years of schooling, I hadn't managed to think through my own passions and how they might match up with the work I found meaningful. As a young person, I'd explored exactly nothing. Barack's maturity, I realized, came in part from the years he'd logged as a community organizer, and even prior to that, a decidedly unfulfilling year he'd spent as a researcher at a Manhattan business consulting firm immediately after college. He'd tried out some things, gotten to know all sorts of people, and learned his own priorities along the way. I, meanwhile, had been so afraid of floundering, so eager for respectability and a way to pay the bills, that I'd marched myself unthinkingly into the law. In the span of a year, I gained Barack and lost Suzanne, and the power of those 2 things together had left me spinning. Suzanne's sudden death had awakened me to the idea that I wanted more joy and meaning in my life. I couldn't continue to live with my own complacency. I both credited and blamed Barack for the confusion. If there were not a man in my life constantly questioning me about what drives me and what pains me, I wrote in my journal, would I be doing it on my own? I mused about what I might do, what skills I might possibly have. Could I be a teacher, a college administrator? Could I run some sort of after-school program? A professionalized version of what I'd done for Cerny at Princeton. I was interested in possibly working for a foundation or a nonprofit. I was interested in helping underprivileged kids. I wondered if I could find a job that engaged my mind and still left me enough time to do volunteer work or appreciate art or have children. I wanted a life, basically. I wanted to feel whole. I made a list of issues that interested me. Education, teen pregnancy, black self-esteem. A more virtuous job, I knew, would inevitably involve a pay cut. More sobering was my next list. This one was of my essential expenses. What was left after I let go of the luxuries I allowed myself on a silly salary? Things like my subscription wine service and health club membership. I had a $600 monthly payment on my student loans, a $407 car payment, money spent on food, gas, and insurance, plus the roughly $500 a month I'd need for rent if I ever moved out of my parents' house. Nothing was impossible, but nothing looked simple either. I started asking around about opportunities in entertainment law, thinking perhaps that it might be interesting and would also spare me the sting of a lower salary. But in my heart, I felt a slow-growing certainty of my own. I wasn't built to practice law. One day, I made note of a New York Times article I'd read that reported widespread fatigue, stress, and unhappiness among American lawyers, most especially female ones. How depressing, I wrote in my journal. I spent a good chunk of that August toiling in a rented conference room at a hotel in Washington, D.C., having been dispatched to help prepare a case. Cillian Austin was representing the chemical conglomerate Union Carbide in an antitrust trial involving the sale of one of its business holdings. I stayed in Washington for about 3 weeks, but managed to see very little of the city because my life was wholly dedicated to sitting in that room with several Sidley peers, opening file boxes that had been shipped from the company headquarters, and reviewing the thousands of pages of documents inside. You wouldn't think I'd be the type of person to find psychic relief in the intricacies of the urethane, polyether, polyol trade, but I did. I was still practicing law, but the specificity of the work and the change of scenery distracted me just enough from the bigger questions beginning to bubble up in my mind. Ultimately, the chemical case was settled out of court, which meant that much of my document reviewing had been for nothing. This was an irksome but expected trade-off in the legal field, where it was not uncommon to prepare for a trial that never came to pass. On the evening I flew home to Chicago, I felt a heavy dread settling over me, knowing that I was about to step back into my everyday routine and the fog of my confusion. My mother was kind enough to meet my flight at O'Hare. Just seeing her gave me comfort. She was in her early 50s now, working full-time as an executive assistant at a downtown bank, which, as she described it, was basically a bunch of men sitting at desks, having gone into the business because their fathers had been bankers before them. My mother was a force. She had little tolerance for fools. She kept her hair short and wore practical, unfussy clothes. Everything about her radiated competence and calm. As it had been when Craig and I were kids, she didn't get involved with our private lives. Her love came in the form of reliability. She showed up when your flight came in. She drove you home and offered food if you were hungry. Her even temper was like shelter to me, a place to seek refuge. As we drove downtown toward the city, I heaved a big sigh. "You okay?" my mom asked. I looked at her in the half light of the freeway. "I don't know," I began. "It's just..." And with that, I unloaded my feelings. I told her that I wasn't happy with my job or even with my chosen profession, that I was seriously unhappy, in fact. I told her about my restlessness, how I was desperate to make a major change, but worried about not making enough money if I did. My emotions were raw. I let out another sigh. "I'm just not fulfilled," I said. I see now how this must have come across to my mother. who was then in the ninth year of a job she'd taken primarily so she could help finance my college education, after years of not having a job so that she'd be free to sew my school clothes, cook my meals, and do laundry for my dad, who, for the sake of our family, spent 8 hours a day watching gauges on a boiler at the filtration plant. My mom, who'd just driven an hour to fetch me from the airport, who was letting me live rent-free in the upstairs of her house, and who would have to get herself up at dawn the next morning in order to help my disabled dad get ready for work, was hardly ready to indulge my angst about fulfillment. Fulfillment, I'm sure, struck her as a rich person's conceit. I doubt that my parents, in their 30 years together, had even once discussed it. My mother didn't judge me for being ponderous. She wasn't one to give lectures or draw attention to her own sacrifices. She'd quietly supported every choice I'd ever made. This time, though, she gave me a wry sideways look, hit her turn signal to get off the highway and back to our neighborhood, and chuckled just a little. "If you're asking me," she said, "I say make the money first and worry about your happiness later." There are truths we face and truths we ignore. I spent the next 6 months quietly trying to empower myself without making any sort of abrupt change. At work, I met with a partner in charge of my division, asking to be given more challenging assignments. I tried to focus on the projects I found most meaningful, including my efforts to recruit a new and more diverse crop of summer associates. All the while, I kept an eye on job listings in the newspaper and did my best to network with more people who weren't lawyers. One way or another, I figured I'd work myself towards some version of feeling whole. At home on Euclid Avenue, I felt powerless in the face of a new reality. My father's feet had started to swell for no obvious reason. His skin looked strangely mottled and dark. Anytime I asked how he was feeling, though, he gave me the same answer, with the same degree of insistence that he'd given me for years. "I'm fine," he'd say, as if the question were never worth asking. He'd then change the subject. It was winter again in Chicago. I woke in the mornings to the sound of the neighbors chipping ice from their windshields on the street. The wind blew and the snow piled up. The sun stayed wan and weak. Through my office window on the 47th floor at Sidley, I looked out at a tundra of gray ice on Lake Michigan and a gunmetal sky above. I wore my wool and hoped for a thaw. In the Midwest, as I've mentioned, winter is an exercise in waiting for relief, for a bird to sing, for the first purple crocus to push up through the snow. You have no choice in the meantime but to pep talk yourself through. My dad hadn't lost his jovial good humor. Craig came for family dinners once in a while, and we sat around the table and laughed the same as always, though we were now joined by Janice, Craig's wife. Janice was happy and hard-driving, a telecommunications analyst who worked downtown and was, like everyone else, completely smitten with my dad. Craig, meanwhile, was a poster child for the post-Princeton urban professional dream. He was getting an MBA and had a job as a vice president at Continental Bank, and he and Janice had bought a nice condo in Hyde Park. He wore tailored suits and had driven over for dinner in his red Porsche 944 Turbo. I didn't know it then, but none of this made him happy. Like me, he had his own crisis brewing, and in coming years would wrestle with questions about whether his work was meaningful, whether the rewards he'd felt compelled to seek were the rewards he actually wanted. Knowing, though, how thrilled our father was by what his kids had managed to accomplish, neither of us ever brought up our discontent over dinner. Saying goodbye at the end of a visit, Craig would give my dad a final concerned look and pose the usual question about his health, only to be given the merry brush off of, I'm fine. We accepted this, I believe, because it was steadying, and steady was how we liked to be. Dad had lived with MS for years and had managed always to be fine.